So I'm curious, how many of you like to listen to the radio on a regular basis? Quite a few, yeah? Some not? Or perhaps podcasts, anybody? Yeah, some podcasts. Well, I listen to the radio quite a bit, especially in the car, but also at home, especially first thing in the morning. Helps me wake up, get my brain going. So for those of us who listen to the radio, and this might apply, as I said, to folks who like podcasts, have you ever had the experience of seeing a picture or perhaps seeing on TV one of the personalities that you know from the radio? Have you had that experience? And perhaps you saw the person whose voice you hear all the time and were surprised at how they look. Have you had this experience? I guess it could happen personally, too, with people that you just know on the phone, right? When you finally meet them, they look different than somehow you imagined. It seems that we have a tendency to unconsciously imagine what someone looks like when we hear their voice. Are you familiar with this phenomenon? Yeah. I've had several experiences of this over the years. After listening to someone on the radio for a long time, I kind of feel like I know them. They're almost like part of the family. And then I see them on TV or in a picture, or I meet them in person, and I'm surprised. Whether it's their age or how thin or tall they are, or you know what their skin color is sometimes, or their cultural heritage. It's happened to me with several of the CBC personalities that I like to listen to. People like Margaret Gallagher and Tom Power. He hosts the national program called The Q. When I saw a picture of him a little ways back, soon after he first started hosting that program, I couldn't believe how young he was. Made me feel old. I knew he was a Newfoundlander. That was obvious. We are funny that way, aren't we? In the absence of any actual knowledge about a person's appearance or their identity, our brains tend to fill in the information based on a person's voice. And a whole bunch of assumptions and preconceptions about what someone with that voice or accent looks like. I think it might happen with literary figures too. I'm sure it does, actually. For those of us who like to read, I remember our son Luke, when he saw the very first Harry Potter movie, which was several years after we had started faithfully, carefully, passionately reading the Harry Potter series, he was a bit shocked and I would say dismayed when he saw some of the actors who portrayed his favorite characters, who he had very clearly pictured in his mind. I mean, he knew exactly what Hogwarts looked like. That's the magical school. That's not what Harry looks like. That's not what Hermione looks like, let alone how to pronounce Hermione. That was a big one for me. You know, we do the same thing with Jesus, right? Have any of you had that reaction this morning to the picture of Jesus that we're using? Did you notice that? Now, I'm sure that you know that Jesus did not take selfies, right? We don't even have paintings or carvings that actually come from the time when Jesus was walking around Galilee and into Jerusalem. But in Jesus' case, we have seen many, many depictions of what Jesus looks like, mostly in paintings or illustrations, and of course, actors in movies. You might date yourself if you remember Max von Sydow in the American epic, The Greatest Story Ever Told, or Robert Powell in Jesus of Nazareth. One of my favorites was Jim Caviezel in The Passion of the Christ. I liked his acting better than I liked the whole movie. We know every culture has depictions of Jesus in their own image. That's great. But most of the depictions that we have seen, maybe all of them, are embarrassingly white, right? We've all seen the hippie, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Jesus a lot. So this picture that you're seeing on the screen and that we're using for this series on rediscovering Jesus, that's the other half of our theme, rediscovering Jesus woven together in love. It's this new portrait of Jesus that was created less than 2 years ago by a Dutch artist named, I think, Bas Uterwijk. He created these images using artificial intelligence software that took all the different images of Jesus throughout the ages and information from historians and anthropologists about that time and that those places, and put them all together to create this photorealistic depiction. It's interesting, isn't it? And does it seem surprising to you? No? The season of Lent is when we remember the 40 days that Jesus spent in solitude and silence and fasting in the wilderness. During this time in the wilderness, Jesus was tested and confronted with his own human vulnerabilities. Through Lent, we are invited into that same space of intentionality to seek Jesus in the silence, coming to terms with our own vulnerability and brokenness. I don't know if you noticed, but the devil or Satan appears in both of our readings today. It's the devil that tempts Jesus while he's fasting out in the wilderness. And it's the name that Jesus calls Peter, and he's upset with him. We'll get back to that in a minute. But devil or Satan simply means adversary, opponent. And there is so much baggage about that word and that figure that it is really hard for us to wade through it all. We have all these assumptions that are built up on John Milton and some other wild writers. But it means adversary, opponent, tempter. That force in our lives that draws us somewhere else than where we want to be. That voice in our head that lies to us, that speaks garbage like, you are not good enough. You don't fit in here. And a lot worse. Diana Butler Bass is one of the authors that we're engaging with in our Jesus Deconstructed study group that just started, and she suggests that the three things that the devil or adversary tempts Jesus with, bread, power, and protection, safety, are not actually three separate things, but part of really one thing, that they're all connected. It was one single, very real temptation. You see, Caesar was the ruler of the world, the emperor of Rome. All of the kingdoms and realms of the Mediterranean were under his power, and all of its inhabitants were required to worship him as Lord and Savior. Caesar maintained control of this diverse, extensive empire in two ways: by providing bread and protection. For most of the first 6 centuries of the Common Era, we used to say AD, the Roman Empire supported a bread dole to hundreds of thousands of people. The distribution of grain to the poor guaranteed the stability of the state. It's hard to rebel against the power that feeds you. Of course, the Roman military was a fearsome force that both conquered territories and then protected them under imperial authority. If Caesar ruled over you, you were at least secure from foreign threats. Bread and safety. It's the temptation that the people of Ukraine are flatly rejecting. Jesus was tempted to be like Caesar, to be a Putin, if you will, a military imperial ruler who reigned with force. And that's what so many people expected Jesus to be, a better emperor, a new liberator. In our other reading from Mark's Gospel, it's an episode that happens just before the one we read last week with the transfiguration on the mountaintop. Jesus has some time alone with the disciples as they're walking between villages. And he asks them, "What are people saying about me?" He couldn't do a Google search. "Who do they say I am?" "Some say John the Baptist," they said, "or Elijah. Others, one of the other prophets." He asked them, "What about you? Who do you say I am?" Peter's is the only answer that we hear. "You are the Christ," he says. And Jesus orders them not to tell anyone. We're not sure why. I'm about to come back to that another time. But then Jesus pulls together, brings the people. They're obviously coming into town, gathers the people with his disciples and says, "The human one must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the legal experts, and be killed. And then after 3 days will rise from the dead." He said this bluntly. "I'm going to be rejected by everyone. I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die." Well, Peter grabs him aside and starts to tell him off. We don't actually hear what he's objecting to. Was he rejecting the idea that Jesus would suffer and die? Or was he just giving good PR advice to tone down the negative message. We're not sure. But what we do know is Jesus had a huge reaction to that. Jesus looked at his disciples, making sure they're listening, and he called out Peter. He called him a name. He called him the devil, the adversary, Satan. Yikes. And he wasn't done there. He called the crowd together and said to them, "All who want to come after me must say no to themselves, take up their cross and follow me. All who want to save their lives will lose them, but those who lose their lives because of me, because of the good news, will save them." Peter didn't want to hear Jesus talk about suffering and death. Who does? But it was too important, too central to Jesus' mission to leave out or even tone down. This isn't just rah, rah, feel good moment of liberation that leads to victory. If people want to join Jesus on his mission, they have to understand that there will be costs. They need to understand what they're in for. God's way was not all sunshine and happiness, not in this world. Not in that world then, and not in our world today. The way of Christ in our shadowed world is about denying our own desires, letting go of our privilege, sacrificing ourselves for others, and it involves suffering. Some might even pay with their lives. The way people in Ukraine are, the way activists in Russia are, and in many other regions of the world. Jesus calls us to take up our crosses and follow him, not just to suffer for its own sake. That's not what Lent is about, and that's not what Jesus is about. But to suffer for the sake of others, for the sake of the common good, for justice. When Jesus faced the temptations in the desert, they were about how to be the Christ, the Messiah, about simply replacing Jesus or Caesar as the imperial ruler by force. The adversary tempted Jesus to become an emperor with a throne instead of a self-giving martyr on a cross. Peter's confession, Peter saying, "You are the Christ," was not a final answer. It was a first answer. And he didn't really have a clue what he was saying. And I'm not sure we are either, myself included. What does Christ mean? What do we expect from Jesus? Who do we say he is? Who is Jesus to us? Who is Christ to us? Just as Peter had a lot to learn about what that word meant, so do we. The Messiah is the anticipation of a leader who leads the people to embody the way of God, the way of life that draws all people to their Creator. Who do you say I am? That is the question that I'm inviting you to wrestle with in these next 6 weeks. What is Jesus to you? Who is he in your life? Is this peasant teacher who lived more than 2,000 years ago, does he have anything to do with your actual life, our life? It's a good question, and you're the only one who can answer it. And why should you? In a world threatened by multiple crises, the climate, the opioid crisis, the pandemic, and now war in Ukraine, not to mention all the other regions of the world where there is terrible warfare and has been. Is this question really that important now? I want to boldly suggest it is. Who do you say Jesus is? And it's important because it's related to all those crises and how we respond to them and what we do about them and how we live and how we order our world. Thinking that Jesus is simply going to replace the Putins of this world, that's the mistake that Peter made and others have made, thinking that that's what Jesus is about. In this journey of Lent, let us consider, who is Jesus for us? What does Christ mean? May God help us rediscover both the Jesus of history and the Christ of mystery.